He is no good. He is plenty of good for himself. His dishonesty will ruin me. Aziz, how monstrous. I am delighted with him, really. He has made my guests comfortable. Besides, it is my duty to employ him. He is my cousin. If money goes, money comes. If money stays, death comes. Did you ever learn that useful Urdu proverb? Probably not, for I have just invented it. My proverbs are, a penny saved is a penny earned. A stitch in time saves nine. Look before you leap, and the British Empire rests on them. You will never kick us out, you know, until you cease employing MLs and such. Oh, kick you out? Why should I trouble over that dirty job? Leave it to the politicians. No, when I was a student, I got excited over your damned countrymen, certainly. But if they'll let me get on with my profession and not be too rude to me officially, I really don't ask for more. But you do. You take them to a picnic. This picnic is nothing to do with English or Indians. It is an expedition of friends. So the cavalcade ended, partly pleasant, partly not. The Brahmin cook was picked up, the train arrived, pushing its burning throat over the plain, and the 20th century took over from the 16th. Mrs. Moore entered her carriage, the three men went to theirs, adjusted the shutters, turned on the electric fan, and tried to get some sleep. Evil was loose. She could even hear it entering the lives of others. And Adela spent days in this atmosphere of grief and depression. Her friends kept up their spirits by demanding holocausts of natives, but she was too worried and weak to do that. When the cactus thorns had all been extracted and her temperature fallen to normal, Ronnie came to fetch her away. He was worn with indignation and suffering, and she wished she could comfort him. But intimacy seemed to caricature itself, and the more they spoke, the more wretched and self-conscious they became. Practical talk was the least painful, and he and McBride now told her one or two things which they had concealed from her during the crisis by the doctor's orders. She learned for the first time of the Mohurrum troubles. There had nearly been a riot. The last day of the festival, the great procession left its official route and tried to enter the civil station, and a telephone had been cut because it interrupted the advance of one of the larger paper towers. McBride and his police had pulled the thing straight, a fine piece of work. They passed on to another and very painful subject, the trial. She would have to appear in court, identify the prisoner, and submit to cross-examination by an Indian lawyer.
"Can Mrs. Moore be with me?" was all she said.
"Certainly, and I shall be there myself," Ronnie replied. "The case won't come before me. They've objected to me on personal grounds. It will be at Chandrapur. We thought at one time it would be transferred elsewhere."
"Miss Quested realizes what all that means, though," said McBride sadly. "The case will come before Das."
Das was Ronnie's assistant, own brother to the Mrs. Bhattacharya whose carriage had played them false last month. He was courteous and intelligent, and with the evidence before him, could only come to one conclusion. But that he should be judge over an English girl had convulsed the station with wrath, and some of the women had sent a telegram about it to Lady Mellenby, the wife of the Lieutenant Governor.
"I must come before someone."
That's the way to face it. You have the pluck, Miss Quested."
He grew very bitter over the arrangements, and called them the fruits of democracy. In the old days, an Englishwoman would not have had to appear, nor would any Indian have dared to discuss her private affairs. She would have made her deposition, and judgment would have followed. He apologized to her for the condition of the country, with the result that she gave one of her sudden little shoots of tears. Ronnie wandered miserably about the room while she cried, treading upon the flowers of the cashmere carpet that so inevitably covered it, or drumming on the brass Benares bowls.
"I do this less every day. I shall soon be quite well," she said,
blowing her nose and feeling hideous.
"What I need is something to do. That is why I keep on with this ridiculous crying."
"It's not ridiculous. We think you wonderful," said the policeman very sincerely. "It only bothers us that we can't help you more. Your stopping here at such a time is the greatest honour this house. He, too, was overcome with emotion. "By the way, a letter came here for you while you were ill," he continued. "I opened it, which is a strange confession to make. Will you forgive me? The circumstances are peculiar. It is from Fielding."
"Why should he write to me?"
"A most lamentable thing has happened. The defence got hold of him."
"He's a crank," said Ronnie lightly.
"That's your way of putting it. But a man can be a crank without being a cad. Miss Quested had better know how he behaved to you. If you don't tell her, somebody else will."
He told her.
"He is now the mainstay of the defence, I needn't add. He is the one righteous Englishman in a horde of tyrants. He receives deputations from the bazaar, and they all chew betel nut and smear one another's hands with scent. It is not easy to enter into the mind of such a man. His students are on strike. Out of enthusiasm for him, they won't learn their lessons."
Fielding wearied of his students. The more they honoured him, the less they obeyed. They lassoed him with jasmine and roses, scratched the splashboard against a wall, and recited a poem, the noise of which filled the lane with a crowd.
"Hurry up, sir! We pull you in a procession!"
And half affectionate, half impudent, they bundled him in.
"I don't know whether this suits you, but anyhow you're safe," he remarked.
The carriage jerked into the main bazaar, where it created some sensation. Miss Quested was so loathed in Chandrapur that her recantation was discredited, and the rumour ran that she had been stricken by the deity in the middle of her lies. But they cheered when they saw her sitting by the heroic principal. Some addressed her as Mrs. Moore, and they garlanded her to match him. Half gods, half guys, with sausages of flowers round their necks, the pair were dragged in the wake of Aziz's victorious landau. In the applause that greeted them, some derision mingled. The English always stick together, that was the criticism. Nor was it unjust. Fielding shared it himself, and knew that if some misunderstanding occurred and an attack was made on the girl by his allies, he would be obliged to die in her defence. He didn't want to die for her, he wanted to be rejoicing with Aziz. Where was the procession going? To friends, to enemies, to Aziz's bungalow, to the collector's bungalow, to the Minto Hospital, where the civil surgeon would eat dust and the patients, confused with prisoners, be released, to Delhi, to Simla. The students thought it was going to Government College. When they reached a turning, they twisted the Victoria to the right, ran it by side lanes down a hill and through a garden gate into the mango plantation. And as far as Fielding and Miss Quested were concerned, all was peace and quiet. The trees were full of glossy foliage and slim green fruit. The tank slumbered. And beyond it rose the exquisite blue arches of the garden house.
"Sir, we fetch the others, sir. It is a somewhat heavy load for our arms," were heard.
Fielding took the refugee to his office and tried to telephone to McBride. But this he could not do. The wires had been cut. All his servants had decamped. Once more he was unable to desert her. He assigned her a couple of rooms, provided her with ice and drinks and biscuits, advised her to lie down, and lay down himself. There was nothing else to do. He felt restless and thwarted as he listened to the retreating sounds of the procession, and his joy was rather spoilt by bewilderment. It was a victory, but such a queer one. At that moment, Aziz was crying,
"Cyril! Cyril!"
Crammed into a carriage with the Nawab Bahadur, Hamidullah, Mahmud Ali, his own little boys, and a heap of flowers, he was not content. He wanted to be surrounded by all who loved him. Victory gave no pleasure. He had suffered too much. From the moment of his arrest, he was done for. He had dropped like a wounded animal. He had despaired, not through cowardice, but because he knew that an Englishwoman's word would always outweigh his own. "It is fate," he said, and "it is fate" when he was imprisoned anew after Muharram. They did not think they were wrong, because as soon as honest people think they are wrong, instability sets up. Not for them was an infinite goal behind the stars, and they never sought it. But wistfulness descended on them now, as on other occasions. The shadow of the shadow of a dream fell over their clear-cut interests, and objects never seen again seemed messages from another world.
"And I do like you so very much, if I may say so," he affirmed.
"I'm glad, for I like you. Let's meet again."
"We will, in England, if I ever take home leave."
"But I suppose you're not likely to do that yet."
"Quite a chance. I have a scheme on now, as a matter of fact."
"Oh, that would be very nice."
So it petered out. 10 days later, Adela went off by the same route as her dead friend, the final beat up before the monsoon had come. The country was stricken and blurred. Its houses, trees and fields were all modelled out of the same brown paste, and the sea at Bombay slid about like broth against the quays. Her last Indian adventure was with Anthony, who followed her onto the boat and tried to blackmail her. She had been Mr. Fielding's mistress, Anthony said. Perhaps Anthony was discontented with his tip. She rang the cabin bell and had him turned out, but his statement created rather a scandal, and people did not speak to her much during the first part of the voyage. Through the Indian Ocean and the Red Sea she was left to herself, and to the dregs of Chandrapur. With Egypt, the atmosphere altered. The clean sands heaped on each side of the canal seemed to wipe off everything that was difficult and equivocal, and even Port Said looked pure and charming in the light of a rose-grey morning. She went on shore there with an American missionary. They walked out to the Lesop statue. They drank the tonic air of the Levant.
"To what duties, Miss Quested, are you returning in your own country after your taste of the tropics?" the missionary asked. "Observe, I don't say to what do you turn, but to what do you return. Every life ought to contain both a turn and a return. This celebrated pioneer," he pointed to the statue, "will make my question clear. He turns to the east, he returns to the west. You can see it from the cute position of his hands, one of which holds a string of sausages."
The missionary looked at her humorously, in order to cover the emptiness of his mind. He had no idea what he meant by turn and return, but he often used words in pairs for the sake of moral brightness.
"I see,"
she replied. Suddenly, in the Mediterranean clarity, she had seen. Her first duty on returning to England was to look up those children of Mrs. Moore's, Ralph and Stella. Then she would turn to her profession. Mrs. Moore had tended to keep the products of her two marriages apart, and Adela had not come across the younger branch so far. Aziz tried to withdraw, but it was too late.
"Quested? Quested? Don't you know that my wife was Mrs. Moore's daughter?"
He trembled and went purplish-grey. He hated the news, hated hearing the name Moore.
"Perhaps this explains your odd attitude."
"And pray what is wrong with my attitude?"
"The preposterous letter you allowed Mahmud Ali to write for you."
"This is a very useless conversation, I consider."
"How ever did you make such a mistake?" said Fielding, more friendly than before, but scathing and scornful. "It's almost unbelievable. I should think I wrote to you half a dozen times, mentioning my wife by name. Miss Quested, what an extraordinary notion."
From his smile, Aziz guessed that Stella was beautiful.
"Miss Quested is our best friend. She introduced us. But what an amazing notion. Aziz, we must thrash this misunderstanding out later on. It is clearly some devilry of Mahmud Ali's. He knows perfectly well I married Miss Moore. He called her Heslop's sister in his insolent letter to me."
The name woke furies in him.
"So she is, and here is Heslop's brother, and you his brother-in-law, and goodbye."
Shame turned into a rage that brought back his self-respect.
"What does it matter to me who you marry? Don't trouble me here at Mau is all I ask. I do not want you. I do not want one of you in my private life. With my dying breath I say it. Yes, yes, I made a foolish blunder. Despise me and feel cold. I thought you married my enemy. I never read your letter. Mahmud Ali deceived me. I thought you'd stolen my money, but..."
He clapped his hands together, and his children gathered round him.
"It's as if you stole it. I forgive Mahmud Ali all things, because he loved me.
Then, pausing while the rain exploded like pistols, he said, My heart is for my own people henceforward, and turned away. Cyril followed him through the mud, apologizing, laughing a little, wanting to argue and reconstruct, pointing out with irrefragable logic that he had married not Heslop's betrothed, but Heslop's sister. What difference did it make at this hour of the day? He had built his life on a mistake, but he had built it. Speaking in Urdu, that the children might understand, he said, Please do not follow us, whomever you marry. I wish no Englishman or Englishwoman to be my friend. He returned to the house, excited and happy. It had been an uneasy, uncanny moment when Mrs. Moore's name was mentioned, stirring memories. As Mrs. Moore, as though she was coming to help him. She had always been so good, and that youth whom he had scarcely looked at was her son, Ralph Moore, Stella and Ralph, whom he had promised to be kind to. And Stella had married Cyril.
Mrs. Moore, this is all extremely strange, because like yourself, I have also two sons and a daughter. Is not this the same box with a vengeance?
Now, what are their names, and not also Ronnie, Ralph, and Stella, surely?
The suggestion delighted him.
No, indeed. How funny it sounds. Their names are quite different, and will surprise you. Listen, please. I am about to tell you my children's names. The first is called Ahmed. The second is called Karim. The third, she is the eldest, Jamila. Three children are enough. Do not you agree with me?
I do.
They were both silent for a little, thinking of their respective families. She sighed and rose to go.
Would you care to see over the Minto Hospital one morning? He inquired. I have nothing else to offer at Chandrapur.
Thank you. I have seen it already, or I should have liked to come with you very much.
I suppose the civil surgeon took you?
Yes, and Mrs. Callender.
His voice altered. Ah, a very charming lady.
Possibly, when one knows her better.
What, what? You didn't like her?
She was certainly intending to be kind, but I did not find her exactly charming.
He burst out with, She has just taken my tonga without my permission. Do you call that being charming? And Major Callender interrupts me night after night from where I am dining with my friends, and I go at once, breaking up a most pleasant entertainment, and he is not there and not even a message. Is this charming, pray? But what does it matter? I can do nothing and he knows it. I am just a subordinate. My time is of no value. The veranda is good enough for an Indian. Yes, yes, let him stand. And Mrs. Callender takes my carriage and cuts me dead.
She listened. He was excited partly by his wrongs, but much more by the knowledge that someone sympathized with them. It was this that led him to repeat, exaggerate, contradict. She had proved her sympathy by criticizing her fellow countrywoman to him, but even earlier he had known. The flame that not even beauty could nourish was springing up, and though his words were querulous, his heart began to glow secretly. Presently it burst into speech.
You understand me. You know what I feel. Oh, if others resembled you.
Rather surprised, she replied,
I don't think I understand people very well. I only know whether I like or dislike them.
Then you are an Oriental.
She accepted his escort back to the club and said at the gate that she wished she was a member so that she could have asked him in. Indians are not allowed into the Chandrapur Club, even as guests, he said simply. He did not expatiate on his wrongs now, being happy. As he strolled downhill beneath the lovely moon, and again saw the lovely mosque, he seemed to own the land as much as anyone owned it. What did it matter if a few flabby Hindus had preceded him there, and a few chilly English succeeded?
You come, we go, my house is left alone. My servant comes back, perhaps, and all my portable property has been carried away by bad characters in the meantime. Would you have that? The cook is deaf. I can never count on my cook. And the boy is only a little boy.
Never, never do I and Hassan leave the house at the same time together. It is my fixed rule. He said all this and much more out of civility to save Dr. Lal's face. It was not offered as truth and should not have been criticized as such. But the other demolished it, an easy and ignoble task.
Even if this is so, what prevents leaving a chit saying where you go?
And so on. Aziz detested ill-breeding and made his pony caper.
Further away, or mine will start out of sympathy,
he wailed, revealing the true source of his irritation.
It has been so rough and wild this afternoon. It spoilt some most valuable blossoms in the club garden and had to be dragged back by four men. English ladies and gentlemen looking on, and the collector Saab himself taking a note. But, Dr. Aziz, I'll not take up your valuable time. This will not interest you, who have so many engagements and telegrams. I am just a poor old doctor who thought right to pay my respects when I was asked and where I was asked. Your absence, I may remark, drew commentaries.
They can damn well comment.
It is fine to be young. Damn well, oh, very fine. Damn whom?
I go or not as I please.
Yet you promise me, and then fabricate this tale of a telegram. Go forward, Dapple.
They went, and Aziz had a wild desire to make an enemy for life. He could do it so easily by galloping near them. He did it. Dapple bolted. He thundered back onto the Medan. The glory of his play with the subaltern remained for a little. He galloped and swooped till he poured with sweat, and until he returned the pony to Hamidullah's stable, he felt the equal of any man. Once on his feet, he had creeping fears. Was he in bad odour with the powers that be? Had he offended the collector by absenting himself? Dr. Panalal was a person of no importance, yet was it wise to have quarrelled even with him? The complexion of his mind turned from human to political. He thought no longer, can I get on with people, but are they stronger than I? Breathing the prevalent miasma. At his home, a chit was awaiting him, bearing the government stamp. It lay on his table like a high explosive, which at a touch might blow his flimsy bungalow to bits. He was going to be cashiered because he had not turned up at the party. When he opened the note, it proved to be quite different. An invitation from Mr. Fielding, the principal of Government College, asking him to come to tea the day after tomorrow. His spirits revived with violence. They would have revived in any case, for he possessed a soul that could suffer but not stifle, and led a steady life beneath his mutability. But this invitation gave him particular joy, because Fielding had asked him to tea a month ago, and he had forgotten about it, never answered, never gone, just forgotten. And here came a second invitation, without a rebuke or even an allusion to his slip. Here was true courtesy, the civil deed that shows the good heart, and snatching up his pen, he wrote an affectionate reply and hurried back for news to Hamidullah's. For he had never met the principal and believed that the one serious gap in his life was going to be filled. He longed to know everything about the splendid fellow, his salary, preferences, antecedents, how best one might please him. But Hamidullah was still out, and Mahmud Ali, who was in, would only make silly, rude jokes about the party.
I would scarcely call her wrong, broke out the Nawab Bahadur from his isolation on the front seat, whither they had relegated him. A native state, a Hindu state, the wife of a ruler of a Hindu state, may beyond doubt be a most excellent lady. And let it not be for a moment supposed that I suggest anything against the character of Her Highness the Maharani of Madgul. But I fear she will be uneducated. I fear she will be superstitious. Indeed, how could she be otherwise? What opportunity of education has such a lady had? Oh, superstition is terrible, terrible. Oh, it is the great defect in our Indian character. And, as if to point his criticism, the lights of the civil station appeared on a rise to the right. He grew more and more voluble. Oh, it is the duty of each and every citizen to shake superstition off And though I have little experience of Hindu states, and none of this particular one, namely Madkul, the ruler, I fancy, has a salute of but 11 guns, yet I cannot imagine that they have been as successful as British India, where we see reason and orderliness spreading in every direction like a most health-giving flood.
Miss Derrick said,
Golly!
Undeterred by the expletive, the old man swept on. His tongue had been loosed, and his mind had several points to make. He wanted to endorse Miss Quested's remark that big people are not interesting, because he was bigger himself than many an independent chief. At the same time, he must neither remind nor inform her that he was big, lest she felt she had committed a discourtesy. This was the groundwork of his oration. Worked in with it was his gratitude to Miss Derrick for the lift, his willingness to hold a repulsive dog in his arms, and his general regret for the trouble he had caused the human race during the evening. Also, he wanted to be dropped near the city to get hold of his cleaner, and to see what mischief his grandson was up to. As he wove all these anxieties into a single rope, he suspected that his audience felt no interest, and that the city magistrate fondled either maiden behind the cover of the harmonium. But good breeding compelled him to continue. It was nothing to him if they were bored, because he did not know what boredom is, and it was nothing to him if they were licentious, because God has created all races to be different. The accident was over, and his life, equably useful, distinguished, happy, ran on as before and expressed itself in streams of well-chosen words. When this old geezer left them, Ronnie made no comment, but talked lightly about polo. Turton had taught him that it is sounder not to discuss a man at once, and he reserved what he had to say on the Nawab's character until later in the evening. His hand, which he had removed to say goodbye, touched Adela's again. She caressed it definitely. He responded, and their firm and mutual pressure surely meant something. They looked at each other when they reached the bungalow, for Mrs. Moore was inside it. It was for Miss Quested to speak, and she said, nervously,
Ronnie, I should like to take back what I said on the Maidan.
He assented, and they became engaged to be married in consequence. Neither had foreseen such a consequence. She had meant to revert to her former condition of important and cultivated uncertainty, but it had passed out of her reach at its appropriate hour. The caves are readily described. A tunnel 8 feet long, 5 feet high, 3 feet wide, leads to a circular chamber about 20 feet in diameter. This arrangement occurs again and again throughout the group of hills. And this is all. This is a Marabar cave. Having seen one such cave, having seen two, having seen three, four, 14, 24, the visitor returns to Chandrapur, uncertain whether he has had an interesting experience or a dull one, or any experience at all. He finds it difficult to discuss the caves or to keep them apart in his mind, for the pattern never varies, and no carving, not even a bee's nest or a bat, distinguishes one from another. Nothing, nothing attaches to them, and their reputation, for they have one, does not depend upon human speech. It is as if the surrounding plain or the passing birds have taken upon themselves to exclaim, "Extraordinary!" And the word has taken root in the air and been inhaled by mankind. They are dark caves. Even when they open towards the sun, very little light penetrates down the entrance tunnel into the circular chamber. There is little to see, and no eye to see it, until the visitor arrives for his 5 minutes and strikes a match. Immediately, another flame rises in the depths of the rock and moves towards the surface like an imprisoned spirit. The walls of the circular chamber have been most marvellously polished. The two flames approach and strive to unite, but cannot, because one of them breathes air, the other stone. A mirror inlaid with lovely colours divides the lovers. Delicate stars of pink and grey interpose, exquisite nebulae, shadings fainter than the tail of a comet or the midday moon, all the evanescent life of the granite only here visible. Fists and fingers thrust above the advancing soil. Here at last is their skin, finer than any covering acquired by the animals, smoother than windless water, more voluptuous than love. The radiance increases, the flames touch one another, kiss, expire. The cave is dark again, like all the caves. Only the wall of the circular chamber has been polished thus. The sides of the tunnel are left rough. They impinge as an afterthought upon the internal perfection. An entrance was necessary, so mankind made one. But elsewhere, deeper in the granite, are there certain chambers that have no entrances? Chambers never unsealed since the arrival of the gods. Local report declares that these exceed in number those that can be visited, as the dead exceed the living. 400 of them, 4,000, or million. Nothing is inside them. They were sealed up before the creation of pestilence or treasure. If mankind grew curious and excavated, nothing, nothing would be added to the sum of good or evil. One of them is rumored within the boulder that swings on the summit of the highest of the hills, a bubble-shaped cave that has neither ceiling nor floor and mirrors its own darkness in every direction infinitely. If the boulder falls and smashes, the cave will smash too, empty as an Easter egg. The boulder, because of its hollowness, sways in the wind and even moves when a crow perches upon it. Hence its name, and the name of its stupendous pedestal, the Kawadol. In the twilight, all resembled corpses, and the train itself seemed dead, though it moved, a coffin from the scientific north, which troubled the scenery four times a day. As it left the Marabars, their nasty little cosmos disappeared, and gave place to the Marabars seen from a distance, finite and rather romantic. The train halted once under a pump to drench the stock of coal in its tender. Then it caught sight of the main line in the distance, took courage, and bumped forward, rounded the civil station, surmounted the level crossing, the rails were scorching now, and clanked to a standstill. Chandrapur! Chandrapur! The expedition was over. And as it ended, as they sat up in the gloom and prepared to enter ordinary life, suddenly the long-drawn strangeness of the morning snapped. Mr. Huck, the inspector of police, flung open the door of their carriage and said in shrill tones,
"Dr. Aziz, it is my highly painful duty to arrest you."
"Hello, some mistake," said Fielding, at once taking charge of the situation.
"Sir, they are my instructions. I know nothing."
"On what charge do you arrest him?"
"I am under instructions not to say."
"Don't answer me like that. Produce your warrant."
"Sir, excuse me. No warrant is required under these particular circumstances. Refer to Mr. McBride."
"Very well. So we will. Come along, Aziz, old man. Nothing to fuss about. Some blunder."
"Dr. Aziz, will you kindly come? A closed conveyance stands in readiness."
The young man sobbed, his first sound, and tried to escape out of the opposite door onto the line.
"That will compel me to use force," Mr. Huck wailed.
"Oh, for God's sake," cried Fielding, his own nerves breaking under the contagion, and pulled him back before a scandal started and shook him like a baby.
A second later, and he would have been out, whistles blowing, a manhunt.
"Dear fellow, we're coming to McBride together and inquire what's gone wrong. He's a decent fellow. It's all unintentional. He'll apologize. Never, never act the criminal."
"My children and my name,"
he gasped, his wings broken.
"Nothing of the sort. Put your hat straight and take my arm. I'll see you through."
"Ah, thank God he comes,"
the inspector exclaimed. They emerged into the midday heat, arm in arm. The station was seething. Passengers and porters rushed out of every recess, many government servants, more police. Ronnie escorted Mrs. Moore. Mohammed Latif began wailing. And before they could make their way through the chaos, Fielding was called off by the authoritative tones of Mr. Turton, and Aziz went on to prison alone.
If it weren't for Fielding, one would never have had the Moorham trouble.
He has done a very grave disservice to the whole community. The letter lay here a day or two, waiting till you were well enough. Then the situation got so grave that I decided to open it in case it was useful to us.
Is it? She said feebly.
Not at all. He only has the impertinence to suggest you have made a mistake.
Would that I had.
She glanced through the letter, which was careful and formal in its wording.
Dr. Aziz is innocent, she read. Then her voice began to tremble again.
But think of his behaviour to you, Ronnie, when you had already to bear so much for my sake. It was shocking of him. My dear, how can I repay you? How can one repay when one has nothing to give? What is the use of personal relationships when everyone brings less and less to them? I feel we ought all to go back into the desert for centuries and try and get good. I want to begin at the beginning. All the things I thought I'd learned are just a hindrance. They're not knowledge at all. I'm not fit for personal relationships. Well, let's go, let's go. Of course, Mr. Fielding's letter doesn't count. He can think and write what he likes, only he shouldn't have been rude to you when you had so much to bear. That's what matters. I don't want your arm. I'm a magnificent walker. No, don't touch me, please.
Mrs. McBride wished her an affectionate goodbye. A woman with whom she had nothing in common and whose intimacy oppressed her. They would have to meet now, year after year, until one of their husbands was superannuated. Truly, Anglo-India had caught her with a vengeance, and perhaps it served her right for having tried to take up a line of her own. Humbled, yet repelled, she gave thanks.
Oh, we must help one another. We must take the rough with the smooth, said Mrs. McBride.
Miss Derrick was there, too, still making jokes about her comic Maharaja and Rani. Required as a witness at the trial, she had refused to send back the Mudkul car. They would be frightfully sick. Both Mrs. McBride and Miss Derrick kissed her and called her by her Christian name. Then Ronnie drove her back. It was early in the morning, for the day, as the hot weather advanced, swelled like a monster at both ends and left less and less room for the movements of mortals.
All that existed in that terrible time was affection. And affection was all that he felt in the first painful moments of his freedom. "Why isn't Cyril following? Let us turn back." But the procession could not turn back. Like a snake in a drain, it advanced down the narrow bazaar towards the basin of the Medan, where it would turn about itself and decide on its prey. "Forward, forward!" shrieked Mahmud Ali, whose every utterance had become a yell. "Down with the collector! Down with the superintendent of police!"
"Mr. Mahmud Ali, this is not wise," implored the Nawab Bahadur.
He knew that nothing was gained by attacking the English, who had fallen into their own pit and had better be left there. Moreover, he had great possessions and deprecated anarchy.
"Cyril, again you desert," cried Aziz.
"Yet some orderly demonstration is necessary," said Hamidullah. "Otherwise they will still think we are afraid."
"Down with the civil surgeon! Rescue Nureddin!"
"Nureddin?
They are torturing him."
"Oh, my God!" For this, too, was a friend. "They are not. I will not have my grandson made an excuse for an attack on the hospital," the old man protested.
"They are. Calendar boasted so before the trial. I heard through the tatties. He said, 'I have tortured that nigger.'"
"Oh, my God, my God. He called him a nigger, did he?
They put pepper instead of antiseptic on the wounds."
"Mr. Mahmud Ali, impossible. A little roughness will not hurt the boy. He needs discipline."
"Pepper. Civil surgeon said so. They hope to destroy us one by one. They shall fail."
The new injury lashed the crowd to fury. It had been aimless hitherto and had lacked a grievance. When they reached the Medan and saw the sallow arcades of the Minto, they shambled towards it, howling. It was near midday. The earth and sky were insanely ugly. The spirit of evil again strode abroad. The Nawab Bahadur alone struggled against it and told himself that the rumour must be untrue. He had seen his grandson in the ward only last week, but he too was carried forward over the new precipice. To rescue, to maltreat Major Callender in revenge, and then was to come the turn of the civil station generally. But disaster was averted, and averted by Dr. Panalal. Dr. Panalal had offered to give evidence for the prosecution in the hope of pleasing the English, also because he hated Aziz. When the case broke down, he was in a very painful position. He saw the crash coming sooner than most people, slipped from the court before Mr. Das had finished, and drove Dapple off through the bazaars in flight from the wrath to come. In the hospital he should be safe, for Major Callender would protect him. But the Major had not come, and now things were worse than ever, for here was a mob entirely desirous of his blood, and the orderlies were mutinous and would not help him over the back wall, or rather hoisted him and let him drop back to the satisfaction of the patients. In agony he cried, "A man can but die the once," and waddled across the compound to meet the invasion, salaaming with one hand and holding up a pale yellow umbrella in the other.
"Oh, forgive me,"
he whined as he approached the victorious landau. Chapter 30. Another local consequence of the trial was a Hindu-Muslim entente. Loud protestations of amity were exchanged by prominent citizens, and there went with them a genuine desire for a good understanding. Aziz, when he was at the hospital one day, received a visit from a rather sympathetic figure, Mr. Das. The magistrate sought two favours from him, a remedy for shingles and a poem for his brother-in-law's new monthly magazine. He accorded both.
"My dear Das, why, when you tried to send me to prison, should I try to send Mr. Bhattacharya a poem, eh?" "That is naturally entirely a joke. I will write him the best I can. But I thought your magazine was for Hindus."
"It is not for Hindus, but Indians generally," he said timidly.
"There is no such person in existence as the general Indian."
"There was not, but there may be when you have written a poem. You are our hero. The whole city is behind you, irrespective of creed."
"I know, but will it last?"
"I fear not," said Das, who had much mental clearness. "And for that reason, if I may say so, do not introduce too many Persian expressions into the poem, and not too much about the bulbul."
"Half a sec," said Aziz, biting his pencil. He was writing out a prescription. "Here you are. Is not this better than a poem?"
"Happy the man who can compose both."
"You are full of compliments today."
"I know you bear me a grudge for trying that case," said the other, stretching out his hand impulsively. "You are so kind and friendly, but always I detect irony beneath your manner."
"No, no, what nonsense," protested Aziz.
They shook hands in a half-embrace that typified the entente. Between people of distant climes there is always the possibility of romance, but the various branches of Indians know too much about each other to surmount the unknowable easily. The approach is prosaic.
"Excellent," said Aziz, patting a stout shoulder and thinking, "I wish they did not remind me of cow dung." Das thought, "Some Muslims are very violent."
They smiled wistfully, each spying the thought in the other's heart, and Das, the more articulate, said,
"Excuse my mistakes. Realize my limitations. Life is not easy as we know it on the earth."
"Oh, well, about this poem. How did you hear I sometimes scribbled?"
he asked, much pleased, and a good deal moved, for literature had always been a solace to him, something that the ugliness of facts could not spoil.
"Professor Godbole often mentioned it before his departure for Mao."
"How did he hear?"
"He too was a poet. Do you not divine each other?"
Flattered by the invitation, he got to work that evening. The feel of the pen between his fingers generated bulbuls at once. His poem was again about the decay of Islam and the brevity of love, as sad and sweet as he could contrive, but not nourished by personal experience and of no interest to these excellent Hindus. Chapter 36. All the time the palace ceased not to thrum and tum-tum. The revelation was over, but its effect lasted, and its effect was to make men feel that the revelation had not yet come. Hope existed despite fulfillment, as it will be in heaven. Although the god had been born, his procession, loosely supposed by many to be the birth, had not taken place. In normal years, the middle hours of this day were signalized by performances of great beauty in the private apartments of the Raja. He owned a consecrated troop of men and boys, whose duty it was to dance various actions and meditations of his faith before him. Seated at his ease, he could witness the three steps by which the Saviour ascended the universe to the discomfiture of Indra, also the death of the dragon, the mountain that turned into an umbrella, and the sadhu who, with comic results, invoked the god before dining. All culminated in the dance of the milkmaidens before Krishna, and in the still greater dance of Krishna before the milkmaidens, when the music and the musicians swirled through the dark blue robes of the actors into their tinsel crowns, and all became one. The Raja and his guests would then forget that this was a dramatic performance and would worship the actors. Nothing of the sort could occur today because death interrupts. It interrupted less here than in Europe. Its pathos was less poignant, its irony less cruel. There were two claimants to the throne, unfortunately, who were in the palace now and suspected what had happened. Yet they made no trouble, because religion is a living force to the Hindus and can at certain moments fling down everything that is petty and temporary in their natures. The festival flowed on, wild and sincere, and all men loved each other and avoided by instinct whatever could cause inconvenience or pain. Aziz could not understand this, any more than an average Christian could. He was puzzled that Mao should suddenly be purged from suspicion and self-seeking. Although he was an outsider and excluded from their rites, they were always particularly charming to him at this time. He and his household received small courtesies and presents, just because he was outside. He had nothing to do all day except to send the embrocation over to the guest house, and towards sunset he remembered it and looked round his house for a local palliative, for the dispensary was shut. He found a tin of ointment belonging to Muhammad Latif, who was unwilling it should be removed, for magic words had been spoken over it while it was being boiled down. But Aziz promised that he would bring it back after application to the stings. He wanted an excuse for a ride. The procession was beginning to form as he passed the palace. A large crowd watched the loading of the state palanquin, the prow of which protruded in the form of a silver dragon's head through the lofty, half-open door. Gods, big and little, were getting aboard. He averted his eyes, for he never knew how much he was supposed to see, and nearly collided with the Minister of Education.
"Ah, you might make me late,"
meaning that the touch of a non-Hindu would necessitate another bath. The words were spoken without moral heat.
"Sorry," said Aziz.
The other smiled, and again mentioned the guest-house party, and when he heard that Fielding's wife was not Miss Quested after all, remarked,
"Ah, no, he married the sister of Mr. Heslop. Ah, exactly. I have known that for over a year."
Also without heat.
"Why did you not tell me? Your silence plunged me into a pretty pickle."
Chapter 3. The third act of Cousin Kate was well advanced by the time Mrs. Moore re-entered the club. Windows were barred, lest the servants should see their memsahibs acting, and the heat was consequently immense. One electric fan revolved like a wounded bird, another was out of order. Disinclined to return to the audience, she went into the billiard room, where she was greeted by,
"I want to see the real India."
And her appropriate life came back with a rush. This was Adela Quested, the queer, cautious girl whom Ronnie had commissioned her to bring from England, and Ronnie was her son, also cautious, whom Miss Quested would probably, though not certainly, marry, and she herself was an elderly lady.
"I want to see it too, and I only wish we could. Apparently the Turtons will arrange something for next Tuesday."
"It'll end in an elephant ride, it always does. Look at this evening. Cousin Kate. Imagine, Cousin Kate. But where have you been off to? Did you succeed in catching the moon in the Ganges?"
The two ladies had happened the night before to see the moon's reflection in a distant channel of the stream. The water had drawn it out so that it had seemed larger than the real moon and brighter, which had pleased them.
I went to the mosque, but I did not catch the moon.
The angle would have altered. She rises later.
Later and later,
yawned Mrs. Moore, who was tired after her walk.
Let me think. We don't see the other side of the moon out here. No.
Come, India's not as bad as all that, said a pleasant voice. Other side of the earth, if you like, but we stick to the same old moon.
Neither of them knew the speaker, nor did they ever see him again. He passed with his friendly word through red brick pillars into the darkness.
We aren't even seeing the other side of the world. That's our complaint, said Adela.
Mrs. Moore agreed. She, too, was disappointed at the dullness of their new life. They had made such a romantic voyage across the Mediterranean and through the sands of Egypt to the harbour of Bombay, to find only a gridiron of bungalows at the end of it. But she did not take the disappointment as seriously as Miss Quested, for the reason that she was 40 years older and had learnt that life never gives us what we want at the moment that we consider appropriate. Adventures do occur, but not punctually. She said again that she hoped that something interesting would be arranged for next Tuesday.
Have a drink, said another pleasant voice. Mrs. Moore, Miss Quested, have a drink, have two drinks.
They knew who it was this time. The collector, Mr. Turton, with whom they had dined. Like themselves, he had found the atmosphere of Cousin Kate too hot. Ronnie, he told them, was stage managing in place of Major Callender, whom some native subordinate or other had let down, and doing it very well. Then he turned to Ronnie's other merits, and in quiet, decisive tones said much that was flattering. It wasn't that the young man was particularly good at the games or the lingo, or that he had much notion of the law. But, apparently a large but, Ronnie was dignified. Mrs. Moore was surprised to learn this, dignity not being a quality with which any mother credits her son. Miss Quested learnt it with anxiety, for she had not decided whether she liked dignified men. She tried, indeed, to discuss this point with Mr. Turton, but he silenced her with a good-humoured motion of his hand and continued what he had come to say.
The long and the short of it is, Heslop's a Saab. He's the type we want. He's one of us.
And another civilian, who was leaning over the billiard table, said,
Hear, hear.
The matter was thus placed beyond doubt, and the collector passed on, for other duties called him. Meanwhile, the performance ended, and the amateur orchestra played the national anthem. Conversation and billiards stopped, faces stiffened. It was the anthem of the Army of Occupation. It reminded every member of the club that he or she was British and in exile. It produced a little sentiment and a useful accession of willpower. Chapter 7. This Mr. Fielding had been caught by India late. He was over 40 when he entered that oddest portal, the Victoria Terminus at Bombay, and, having bribed a European ticket inspector, took his luggage into the compartment of his first tropical train. The journey remained in his mind as significant. Of his two carriage companions, one was a youth, fresh to the east like himself, the other a seasoned Anglo-Indian of his own age. A gulf divided him from either. He had seen too many cities and men to be the first, or to become the second. New impressions crowded on him, but they were not the orthodox new impressions. The past conditioned them, and so it was with his mistakes. To regard an Indian as if he were an Italian is not, for instance, a common error, nor perhaps a fatal one, and Fielding often attempted analogies between this peninsula and that other, smaller and more exquisitely shaped, that stretches into the classic waters of the Mediterranean. His career, though scholastic, was varied, and had included going to the bad and repenting thereafter. By now he was a hard-bitten, good-tempered, intelligent fellow, on the verge of middle age, with a belief in education. He did not mind whom he taught. Public schoolboys, mental defectives, and policemen had all come his way, and he had no objection to adding Indians.
Through the influence of friends, he was nominated principal of the little college at Chandrapur, liked it, and assumed he was a success. He did succeed with his pupils, but the gulf between himself and his countrymen, which he had noticed in the train, widened distressingly. He could not at first see what was wrong. He was not unpatriotic. He always got on with Englishmen in England. All his best friends were English. So why was it not the same out here? Outwardly of the large, shaggy type, with sprawling limbs and blue eyes, he appeared to inspire confidence until he spoke. Then, something in his manner puzzled people and failed to allay the distrust which his profession naturally inspired. There needs must be this evil of brains in India, but woe to him through whom they are increased. The feeling grew that Mr. Fielding was a disruptive force, and rightly, for ideas are fatal to caste, and he used ideas by that most potent method, interchange. Neither a missionary nor a student, he was happiest in the give and take of a private conversation. The world, he believed, is a globe of men who are trying to reach one another and can best do so by the help of goodwill plus culture and intelligence, a creed ill-suited to Chandrapur, but he had come out too late to lose it. He had no racial feeling, not because he was superior to his brother civilians, but because he had matured in a different atmosphere, where the herd instinct does not flourish. The remark that did him most harm at the club was a silly aside to the effect that the so-called white races are really pinko-grey. He only said this to be cheery. He did not realise that white has no more to do with a colour than God save the king with a god, and that it is the height of impropriety to consider what it does connote. The pinko-grey male whom he addressed was subtly scandalised. His sense of insecurity was awoken, and he communicated it to the rest of the herd. Still, the men tolerated him for the sake of his good heart and strong body. It was their wives who decided that he was not a Saab, really. They disliked him. He took no notice of them, and this, which would have passed without comment in feminist England, did him harm in a community where the male is expected to be lively and helpful. Unlike the green bird or the hairy animal, she was labelled now. She felt humiliated again, for she deprecated labels, and she felt, too, that there should have been another scene between her lover and herself at this point, something dramatic and lengthy. He was pleased instead of distressed. He was surprised, but he had really nothing to say. What indeed is there to say? To be or not to be married? That was the question. And they had decided it in the affirmative. Come along, and let's tell the mater all this. Opening the perforated zinc door that protected the bungalow from the swarms of winged creatures. The noise woke the mater up. She had been dreaming of the absent children who were so seldom mentioned, Ralph and Stella, and did not at first grasp what was required of her. She too had become used to thoughtful procrastination, and felt alarmed when it came to an end. When the announcement was over, he made a gracious and honest remark. Look here, both of you. See India if you like, and as you like. I know I made myself rather ridiculous at Fielding's, but it's different now. I wasn't quite sure of myself.
My duties here are evidently finished. I don't want to see India now. Now for my passage back, was Mrs. Moore's thought.
She reminded herself of all that a happy marriage means, and of her own happy marriages, one of which had produced Ronnie. Adela's parents had also been happily married, and excellent it was to see the incident repeated by the younger generation. On and on. The number of such unions would certainly increase as education spread and ideals grew loftier and characters firmer. But she was tired by her visit to Government College. Her feet ached. Mr. Fielding had walked too fast and far. The young people had annoyed her in the tum-tum, and given her to suppose that they were breaking with each other. And though it was all right now, she could not speak as enthusiastically of wedlock or of anything as she should have done. Ronnie was suited. Now she must go home and help the others if they wished.
She was past marrying herself, even unhappily. Her function was to help others, her reward to be informed that she was sympathetic. Elderly ladies must not expect more than this. They dined alone. There was much pleasant and affectionate talk about the future. Later